Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and here with me is Coach Chad Timmerman. How you doing, Chad?
Doing well, Jonathan. Thanks.
Good to hear. And founder of Trainer Road, Nate Pearson. How's it going, Nate?
Going great.
Good to hear. We've got a lot of questions from you guys today, and that's what this podcast is all about. It gives you an opportunity to get answers to your coaching, cycling, and training-related questions. You can submit these to us by just getting in touch at support@trainerroad.com, and we'll get all the questions and filter and organize them up for this show, and hopefully we can get to all of them this week. We get a lot of questions, so sometimes we don't get to all of them, but we'll do our best. You can find this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. You can just search for Trainer Road or Ask a Cycling Coach, and you'll find it on there. If you do see it there, please leave us a review. We'd appreciate that. Let us know what you like about the show. Give us 5 stars. We like 5 stars a lot. So if you want to give us that, that'd be great. And yeah, we appreciate all of you joining us. Let's get right into it with Andrew's question. His question is, how would I use my FTP in real-world events? Obviously, if I'm taking part in a time trial, which is around the 1 hour mark, then this is easy. But I don't compete in these types of events. For example, a 100 mile one day event covering rolling terrain with lots of steep hard climbs spread throughout the ride. So it sounds like a tough century ride. When taking part in such events that last over 4 hours, for example, and have multiple climbs and aren't consistent, can I use my FTP to develop a strategy for the event? And you mentioned that you do have a power meter, Andrew. How could he do this, Chad?
So Andrew, I'm going to assume that these judgments are up to you, that this isn't dictated by someone else's racing tactics, in which case it's largely experience-based, a little bit of trial and error. So if you know that over the course of a long event, it's going to finish with some hard climbs, then you can over time determine, you know, how hard can I hit a climb that lasts 2 minutes or a climb that I'm geared out and I have to mash it for 5 minutes. It's going to be pretty subjective. And if it's entirely up to you, you know, you can decide exactly where those wattage ranges, how narrow or wide they may be, fall, and then just try to adhere to them. But it's going to take a lot of experience on your part.
Yeah, so my input on this is a couple things. One, I made the mistake of when I was new to having a power meter, I was in a road race and I was like, okay, I know that if I go this far above, it's going to really burn me out. So I'm going to get to the front of the group on a climb. And I'm going to fade back and not go above this certain percentage of my FTP. I did that and I was dropped like on the second climb because I was paying too much attention to my power meter in a race. So if you're doing anything where like drafting is like a big part of it, where on the, you know, on the flats, if you're drafting, it's really easy. Don't look at your power meter at all. Just keep up with the group. Second, if you're doing like a big 100 mile ride and it's more of like a group event, and if you're not with that group, it doesn't matter because another group's going to come by, or just trying to do something quickly. As Chad said, you can kind of use it as a pacing thing. So if you're going up a climb and it's a 5 minute climb, 10 or 20 minute climb, and you're with the group, pay attention to your power meter and don't just try to like blow yourself up, because at these longer events, it's easy for the first, you know, 10, 20, 30 miles to really hammer it. And then you're suffering for the rest of it and you end up with a slower time. So maybe if you're with the group and you hit a climb and, you know, you're jamming it, you're at 120% FTP, know that you're not going to be able to sustain that. So instead of trying to sustain it for 5 minutes and then blowing up and you're going to drop the group anyways, like back off, you know, to depending on the length of the climb, 105 or 100% or 90% of FTP, whatever the length is, and just wait for the next group that comes up and you can grab onto them and you'll have a better experience. And I bet you'll have a faster overall time than blowing up really early on the course.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I know I use, so as what you guys said, I never judge my effort on if I'm going with an attack or anything else just based off of power data, but I do reference it. And I've used that to successfully a number of times to manage breakaways or solo breakaways or,
ooh, yeah,
or
breakaways.
Anything else in races. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a great tool. Mm-hmm. So for example, you're mentioning how you use your FTP. If you view any effort as a percentage of your FTP, and then if you're also tracking your training and you know, for example, my 5 minute power is this, my 10 minute power is this, my et cetera, at those different scales. And that can really help you, especially on something like a criterium course, which you're going to be doing laps on. If you can roughly estimate what's going to happen throughout the rest of the race, like you would in a criterium, obviously you might not be able to anticipate the attacks, but at least you know the course, then you can make some pretty good judgment calls with that that I guess Power Data can really help in making those decisions. One way, another tip with this also is to use Best Bike Split. Best Bike Split is a service that you can use online. You plug in your FTP and as well as many other variables that you have, like the type of helmet you have, you can get very detailed with it. You enter in all that information, and then it, based off of your FTP, can generate an ideal pacing plan for you for that race. And although that seems like a great thing for a time trial and maybe not a road race, I have actually used it to win two different road races successfully on solo breakaways. So, and really, I just kept an eye on my normalized power, and Best Bike Split told me that based off of your FTP and what you can do, you shouldn't break X for your power. That should be your normalized power at the end of the race. So I made sure that I pushed hard, but certainly didn't cross my limits or, you know, sell myself short either. And I was able to manage to pull off some wins. So once again, it's not necessarily racing by the numbers. You still end up having to do the work, but the numbers can be really informative.
Another thing with that is breakaway or a chase group. That's really important is when it's your time to pull. Some guys will just try to do these, you know, monster pulls, and you end up blowing yourself out or blowing yourself up, and you won't, you know, you'll go out the back. It's if you know you can pull and do your 30-second pull at 350 watts, just every time you pull, go 350. Don't just go, I'm going to pull as hard as I can. So it starts off at like 420 watts, and then by the end of your 30 seconds, you're at 280. You've made the whole group more tired because you're getting a, you know, an accordion effect on your group. It's a great way to pace in breakaways. Or I've done it too, where I've been on a solo break for a crit, and I get that separation. And I think there's enough room that all I have to do is kind of maximize my speed until the end. And then I look at my power meter and say, okay, I've got about 4 minutes of racing left. I can do, you know, 350 watts for 4 minutes or something like that. So I'm not going to start going 480 and then kind of die. I'm going to pace for 350. Or wait, 325. Yeah, what did I say? Whatever I said.
Yeah. Along the same lines as what Nate's just talking about is you can use your power data to let you know, am I with the right group? Is this a group that's going to suit me? I mean, they're taking pulls so hard and fast that I have to skip every fourth, fifth turn, or they're climbing this hill so fast that I'm dangling off the back. This isn't a realistic group for me to be with. So it can help you, especially in the case of a 100-mile ride where you're 20 miles in, like Nate also talked about. You don't want to blow yourself up and just hobble home and hate the last 80 miles of a very long ride.
Yeah, and in that case, and I guess getting specific, and this really does depend on the course and your abilities and how accurately your FTP has been assessed. But Chad, I mean, roughly what, anywhere from 60 to 70% or up or down of that slightly, what do you think would be a good ballpark for somebody to shoot for on their average power after on a four-hour ride?
For something like 4 hours, I would say probably in the ballpark of 0.7 to 0.8, realistically. I mean, if you take like a Ironman triathlete, the high-end pros over 112 miles, so, you know, roughly the same.
I think, yeah, but are going to do if you're going really fast.
Exactly. 0.8 is kind of the upper end of things. You exceed that, and it's a good indication that your FTP is probably a little underestimated. But if you stayed safely around, you know, 70% or 0.7 intensity factor, you're safe to say you're not going to hate the whole ride.
Yeah, and that 70% intensity factor, it's 70% of your threshold power, right? So, or of your FTP, better said. So that's a good, hopefully it gives you enough guidance there on that one. Luke has another question. Luke asks, I've just started on the sweet spot based training plan and was wondering if there's any special reason these sweet spot blocks are 5 weeks on and 1 week off, and they follow that 6 week cycle, rather than having the common training block format of 3 weeks on and 1 week off, like your traditional base build and specific build, training blocks are. Chad, can you give us some info on that one?
Yes.
Why are the base cycles a little longer?
Yeah, that was specific to when I actually developed those plans, and I got to put them in use and see firsthand how riders responded to them in indoor training studios. And it turned out that when the 4 week point rolled around, people weren't really, they're never eager to assess, but they certainly weren't eager at that point. And they were still kind of on the upswing. They didn't really need a recovery week just yet. So I pushed it out to 6 weeks just to see how things went, and people were still responding positively. So we kind of pushed things forward such that sixth week was a recovery week instead of a fourth week. And that might be due largely to the nature of sweet spot training and the fact that it doesn't exact as high a toll as the higher intensity stuff. For whatever reason, 6 weeks seemed to be about as much stress, or 5 weeks, I should say, about as much stress as people could handle before they needed that 6 week recovery.
And two, it's just like, don't think that things have to be three on, one off, three on, one off.
Yeah.
There's some of that came from the 80s with Russians doing steroids, and they had great, you know, that's what they would advocate, because that 1 week off, would they be cycling their drugs. So it would, you know, they do 3 weeks of lots of steroids and 1 week of not so much steroids. And that kind of came into the culture of clean riders too, that I need to do this. It's more what we advocate here at Trainer Road is everybody's different, and you really have to pay attention. So you can follow the plans and do that, but really listen to your body. And, you know, you can switch between low or mid volume or high volume to mid volume, and, you know, any way you want, but it don't follow dogma. So like if you're in mid volume and you're doing it and this is way too much for you, it's okay to drop back. It's everyone's different. It's not like a knock on you.
Yeah. And the other side of that is, you know, these go 5 weeks on and then you get your recovery week. Maybe that works. Maybe, and in this case, it worked for a lot of people. But take, for example, masters athletes who don't recover quite like they used to. There's nothing wrong with switching that or swinging that the other way, where instead of going 3 weeks and taking a week off, they go 2 weeks and take a week off. I mean, these plans, any plan is flexible in that you have to tailor it to your training response, to your recovery response. So it could go either way. Maybe you respond better to larger doses of stress before you hit that recovery cycle. Maybe you have to interject more recovery cycles relative to how many work cycles.
Great info. And that's a commonly asked question. So Brett, can you talk a little bit about how to adjust your training plan if the results after a phase are not as good as expected? For example, I just finished sweet spot base one. While I definitely improved on my ability to handle long, repeated sweet spot intervals, I saw no increase in FTP. So first of all, before we move any further, Chad, do you want to address that part? Because first of all, I mean, sweet spot base isn't directly intended to be a build plan, right, to raise your FTP?
No, but you do see, it's common to see a pretty good bump in FTP over the course of those 6 weeks. So my first guess is that your FTP is perhaps a little underestimated, and that you're not actually pushing yourself as hard as the workouts require to see the improvements that most people often do. Secondly, you might not be performing them to the best of your ability. You might be a little overtaxed. You know, maybe the 5 weeks on, 1 week off format doesn't suit you. In any case, something does need to change. So you're right. I don't necessarily think you need to repeat a training phase. Each one of these begins with an assessment for, you know, that the very reason. We want to see where you're starting and then scale the subsequent workouts accordingly. So you can move on to sweet spot base two. It's a similar plan anyways.
Yeah, so maybe he could just increase his FTP by, I think we talked before, what did we say, 5%?
Probably 5%.
5 watts?
Yeah, 3 to 5% seems to be the catch-all for most people. And you may find that when you're second FTP assessment rolls around, you've got a better sense of how to pace for that, of how to push yourself a little bit harder. And you may get a number that's more representative of your capabilities, and everything beyond that point is going to go that much better.
Todd, you say, first off, Trainer Road is the best. We agree. That's awesome. I get really into the metrics and data, and I often find that I enjoy it more than my long outdoor rides. That's good. Strangely enough, that happens to most people if they're following a
training plan. Happens with me, Todd.
Yep, me too. And I never thought that would happen. So, and this was before I worked for Trainer Road. So I'm a fairly competitive triathlete. I've won a few local races, competed in Kona in 2014, and get a good amount of my riding time during my daily bike commutes to work. In fact, we just had a baby, so my ride time is even more limited. My bike commute is about 45 minutes each way, and sometimes I tack on a little extra for some more volume. So his question has to do with commuting. When I am in my base phase of training, how important is it for me to keep my daily commutes also in this base phase? In other words, he's talking about the intensity of his workout, keeping it the intensity low. Most of the time, I incorporate some short, hard efforts on my bike commute, anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes. I was wondering if doing these would be detrimental or defeat the purpose of an 8 to 16 week base phase.
The only way they're going to be detrimental, Todd, is if you're sacrificing some other workout at their expense. So if by, you know, riding these short commutes to work at high intensities and then you come into your the rest of your workouts flat, then yeah. But I think, and this is a common concern when base training rolls around, is that people think that high intensity training is going to reverse some of the adaptation they gain from low intensity training. And it's just not the fact, or that's not how it works. The fact of the matter is that you have so much time to work with. How are you going to devote that time? So if you're looking for a long, slow approach and you're trying to condition your system to metabolize fat, but you're spending some of that time working on high intensity efforts, well, it's coming at the expense of your intended adaptation. So it's not like one flies in the face of the other or one's going to negate the effects of the other. Rather, you have so much time and you have to prioritize how you're going to spend that time.
Todd also asks, when I'm doing these short, hard efforts, is it better to keep these to just my morning or just my evening commutes, or is it okay to do them but both times? Is that just too taxing on the anaerobic system? Chad, what do you say about that? Is there a better time to do them? Commuting into work or out?
It's a similar answer. I mean, if you do it both and then you're so tired that you can't do your subsequent workouts better, then obviously limit it to one or the other. Then there's also a concern that you're just pushing yourself too hard. I mean, if you do one hard workout in the morning and then follow it shortly with another hard workout, you are actually interrupting your recovery. So that eventually could lead to a plateau. You could start going backwards. Personally, I'd recommend taking it easy. In my opinion, I'd go easy to work so I didn't arrive sweaty and a mess. And then I'd go hard on the way home knowing that I've got not only a shower, but probably a meal awaiting.
So everyone knows Chad just showed up to a meeting yesterday, totally covered in sweat after a bike workout.
It's true.
This is true.
what Todd's saying is, it sounds like his short, hard efforts are short and not the majority of it. So it's not like he's jamming into work, you know, just a hill. Yeah. And he wants to get that Strava, the Strava award on that hill to go as high as he can.
Sure. Okay. And those little efforts have vast benefit. I mean, it's like you're keeping tabs on your higher energy delivery systems. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You don't have to let all that slip away. And maintenance, and we're going to touch on this later because it also is a common theme this week, is really simple when it comes to those higher energy systems, the anaerobic and the VO2 max stuff. So, rather than lose all that stuff in the winter because you've devoted all your time or you're turning all your time to base training and aerobic conditioning, you can maintain those systems with very little weekly attention.
Dan, I'm relatively new to Trainer Road and I've been tinkering around for the last 5 to 6 weeks. Your 8-minute test has already shown an improvement in FTP, moving from 287 to 311. Nice work. That's good. Wow. So really happy with things already. You're using virtual power, and this has revolutionized your training. So your question, when I finish, so you're following a base plan right now, and you ask, when I finish sweet spot base 1, do I then move on to sweet spot base 2, or do I move straight into a selected build program, say sustained power build? So what he's referring to here, and we've mentioned this before in the podcast, but it bears mentioning again, the way that we break down our training plans are into 3 different phases: a base phase, a build phase, and a specialty phase. So he's just talking about the base phase right now and asking if what he should do there. So Chad, when he finishes sweet spot base 1, should he move? How should he progress?
Yeah, Dan, if you actually have the 12 hours or 12 weeks to devote to base training, then that's how they're structured. Sweet spot base 1 builds into sweet spot base 2 in that it's a continuation. So the TSS keeps on rising, the workouts get a little more challenging. And this is something else that has also been asked a few times this week. If you need to trim something, we'll get to this later, but I'll touch on it now. You can, if you need to, if you're pinched for time, simply do the first 6 weeks of sweet spot base 1 and then begin a build program or a build plan. But if you have 12 weeks to devote to base, there are a few better ways that you can spend your time. I highly, highly advocate a full 12 weeks of base conditioning.
And then he also has a question, if he's moving on from one phase to the next or one training block to the next, should he take a rest week in between them?
Yeah, that's up to you. That 6th week is a recovery week. So the stress, the workload that you face in week 5 is going to dip sharply, such that week 6 serves as a little bit of a recovery, a refresher, and you're ready to roll, in this case, into sweet spot base 2. That's, as always, subjective, though. If at the end of that recovery week you still don't feel refreshed and now you got to do an FTP test and dive into another hard week of training, maybe add another couple of days of rest or maybe even a full week.
But don't think that you need a week. That's I think some people get into that spot where they go, I have to have a week off here or else I'm not going to get the adaptations that I want. And that's not true, especially between Sweet Spot Base 1 and Sweet Spot Base 2.
That's a good point, too. These recovery weeks are structured as entire weeks, and that's mostly for convenience because people, you know, I can work out on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, or Saturday, so I have to make that work for me from week to week to week. So we make that whole week a recovery week. That doesn't necessarily mean everyone needs an entire week of recovery. A lot of the times I take 3, maybe 4 days in rare circumstances of downtime before I'm really ready to get after it again, especially in the early phases of training.
And I know last year, for example, I moved through without any type of extra rest weeks other than those that were prescribed in my training plan. And I went through base build, specialty, back to a build, and back to specialty. And I didn't take any of the weeks off. So yeah, once again, as Chad has already mentioned, it's all about paying attention to what works best for you. But just to give you, I guess, an anecdote there. So, Steve, I'm 3 weeks into Sweet Spot Base low volume, so that's one of our training plans, and then plan to do a build for 8 weeks. This takes me to mid-March when I have a four-day training camp, after which I'll do the 8-week crit plan. So you got your whole stuff laid out, right? You're planning to race mostly criteriums from May to July. So your question, what should I do to keep my peak fitness up over those 12 weeks? Should I repeat the crit specialty program, including my races, to see me through July and summer holiday? So he wants to maintain his peak for 12 weeks. Chad, what do you recommend for that?
Yeah, so obviously you're not going to hold peak fitness that whole time, but you want to stay sharp and race well over the course of 12 weeks. And this goes back to what I was talking about earlier, and that maintaining those higher energy delivery systems, you know, the hard stuff, which, you know, you're going to encounter a lot of within your criterium races. So I'm assuming you're racing at least once a week. So there's one day of intensity a week. If you can get in another, you're probably good to go. You're probably going to maintain everything that you're trying to hang on to. Beyond that, it's all about recovery and easy mileage. So if you want to spend time riding, and you maybe could incorporate a third day of intervals, in which case you can cherry pick anything that really worked for you over the course of that criterium plan. But you're just looking for, you know, maybe like a Tuesday, Thursday set of intervals, unless, of course, you have Tuesday night crits, which, you know, that counts as your interval workout. And then something maybe a little bit longer and harder on the weekends. But the point of this is you don't have to do much to maintain the fitness. Building it's the hard part. Hanging on to it is really very manageable.
That sounds like a lot of fun, too. 12 weeks of crits.
It does.
I know, right? That's the best. And I know that I actually received that almost that same exact question from another athlete, actually a local athlete here who's preparing for collegiate nationals. So that answers for you as well, Jeff. That covers it very well. Bodo, I will have 21 weeks, or actually we'll just cut straight to your question. Your question is, you're going to follow a base build specialty training plan that you have. So you're going to follow the 3 different phases of training that we have, and that adds up to 28 weeks. But you need to fit it into 21 weeks. Should I just focus on Sweet Spot 1 and 2 and then general build? Or should I shorten Sweet Spot Base? So Chad, he needs to cut out 7 weeks there. Where should he cut that out? And is that possible?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible. Anything, you know, you have to do what you have to do. You can go kind of either end of this. You can do just focus on your sweet spot, 12 weeks of it. Just work on building that muscle endurance and raising your FTP. That in and of itself is going to lead to better race outcomes. And then you move into your build plan. Either way, the build's going to be part of it. So if you shorten your base and then move directly into your build training, and then you have time for some of your specialty training, that's one way to do it, by trimming off that first 6 weeks or that second 6 weeks of Sweet Spot Base. Alternatively, you could do the full 12 weeks of Sweet Spot Base and then just start plugging through your build. What people may not realize is that over the course of even the Sweet Spot Base plans, but certainly the build plans, you're race ready. I mean, you're not in peak fitness. You're not going to have you may not have your best races. You know, your fitness is still on the way up, but you're definitely ready to get out there and compete.
Jim, you have a question about overload that we can cover. So the overload principle. I typically plan my 3 months of base training to culminate with my team's annual training camp the second week of March, or week However, due to an injury, I will be getting a late start this year, and camp will fall around the second month of base. Camp is a huge spike in TSS. You have 8 days, 550 miles, 24 hours of riding in 8 days. That's a long week. So this is somewhat similar in the sense that you're going to have to be doing some modifying, but your main question is that too much to pile on that early in base, especially given that I won't be able to recreate that amount of stress again for the remainder of the spring? Chad, you just went to a training camp yourself, so you'd have, I assume, some insight on this.
Yeah, these big doses of overload can be tremendously productive. So you have to determine, is it productive for you? This sounds pretty legit. So, and it also sounds like maybe you've done it before. So do you come out of this feeling tired for a couple weeks, or do you come out of it feeling tired for a few days and then you rally and your whole base of fitness has risen a bit? Which is the idea of these training camps, these big doses of overload, is to put more stress on your body than, far more than it's accustomed to gain a bigger training stimulus, a bigger training adaptation. So if you can benefit from it and it kind of elevates your entire game, then it's absolutely time well spent. But if it beats you down, you get sick or injured or in any way derails your training progress, then something about it has to change. And it doesn't necessarily mean you need to skip the entire camp so much as maybe, the 6-hour rides or 4-hour rides for you, or 5 days is trimmed down to 4 days.
I know I've always found that going through those camps as well, if I do come into that and I just do my best to prepare rather than cramming and trying to, get ahead of myself with it, but I just take things in stride, that generally it all ends up working out, especially if you have experience with this beforehand, which, like Chad said, you feel like you already does. So, yeah, and no panic there.
Jonathan, you can, for people who don't know, Jonathan can handle way more stress than I can. I'm like a little baby with the amount of stress I can take. And if I were coming to this camp, I would just make sure that when I come in, I'm not super tired. And then when I come out, I wouldn't tell myself, okay, it ended on a Saturday, and then that next Tuesday is like I'm going right back into interval training. I would probably give myself it almost sounds like, an Ironman. Like I did this really big set of rests, and I got a plan for the rest after that. And as long as Chad mentioned this before, as long as that camp doesn't derail all of your training afterwards, it can be a really good thing. But and don't think just because it's in the middle of your base season, it's going to destroy your base training. It's like a way to put it, Jed.
Yeah, no, I fully agree.
And I'm not sure what your training camp is going to be like, but I know that in most situations, even high-level training camps, there are different objectives for different members of the team. And if you do find yourself hanging with the usual suspects, but it's just a little too high of a pace, just keep that long-term perspective in mind. It's worth
it. Yeah, great point.
It's so hard too, right? You get in there with your teammates and it's the first, real training camp, and you just want to make it a slugfest. So our filmmaker was just with Chad, or they're on the same team this year, and they went out there and I think he's at peak form right now in this year, just for that training camp.
Yes,
and he was first one to all the climbs. So, don't let that happen. Ian, I am a USAC, or so you're a Cat 3 roadie, you say, a type A competitive person. I think pretty much everyone is,
we
right?
All
that's
are.
Racing bikes. We all are. Up until this point, I've treated all of my races as A races. Why would someone enter a race and treat it as a B or C race and not try to win? What would that accomplish? This guy is competitive. I'm looking at this through the scope of wasting a drive and entry fees for a race that I know I'm not going to win. Yeah, I think we all have input on this one, but Chad, kick it off.
Boy, there are a lot of reasons. Just general race experience is one. Upgrade points or upgrade races is another. The fact that you simply can't win every race, and trying to, set your expectations so high. I mean, you're basically you're racing on a kind of an all or nothing strategy. You either fully succeed or you fail. It's kind of an all or nothing sort of deal. That can get kind of dehumanizing or demoralizing after a while. And the fact is, you can't maintain peak fitness for very long. So you have to choose which races are most important, which are the races where I'm going to push my, my training to its furthest point, and then try to reap the benefit in a timely manner. and get those race results that are particularly important. I understand going to a race and wanting to do well every time, and there's nothing wrong with that. But shooting for a victory each and every time is a bit unrealistic.
Well, too, I think that the crux of it is, like, when we say a race and what you're training for, it's really about how much of a taper you're going to put on that A race. So if you're, you know, we say, like, during base phase, you maybe your C races, B races during build, and then during your in season, that's where you can have an A race or a couple A races. But if I'm going to do a race every weekend, let's say I have Sunday races, my most important race is, you know, I'm not going to do a huge workout on Saturday, but if I'm building up for something that I really want to accomplish, I will train on Saturday because I need that extra stress. You know what I mean? It's like, you don't want to taper for every race, because then you're never going to get the amount of week over week stress that your body needs to get more fit. So
that's a really good point.
One thing is, like, going into every race and, like, yes, I go into triathlon, I want to beat my best time every time. I want to kill the bike split, and that's great. But it's really, like, what position do I come with my body to be able to perform the best? And with triathlon, you might peak for a half or an Ironman once or twice a year, but I'm not going to, you know, I might do a sprint race that takes about an hour, and I won't taper for that. I won't have an easy week ahead of that. I'll just switch out a workout for that race.
Yeah. And you guys have brought up great points about the physiological standpoint. In other words, if you do allow yourself to come to a peak of fitness, that it won't last particularly long. And it allows you to actually really time your form so that you fulfill more of your potential, right? So that's one great thing that Chad mentioned, and then Nate, fantastic point there on building up more. And I'd like to touch on the mental aspects of things, and perhaps it's because, Nate, you mentioned that you can't take much stress. I tend to be a weakling mentally, I guess, because one of the things that if I tell myself to win every time, I'll get mentally exhausted if I'm going to be pushing myself for that. Now, don't get me wrong. I still race. If I have an objective in a race other than to win, I am going to follow that objective like it's a win, right? So, I mean, Chad has mentioned before a few times with criteriums, okay, get off the front, and Chad's just guided me through a few different things, but Chad's mentioned that I need to get off the front and I need to, you know, spend a few laps by myself and then repeat that a certain amount of times during a race. And I make that my win for that race. That's my goal. And I'm going to accomplish that goal to the best of my ability. But I almost trend my mental strength and that race day confidence when you're so good that nobody can beat you. There's no possible way. I like to think of that, at least with my mind. I try to trend that with my fitness. So that's building up in parallel with my fitness so that those two things align really well. And you seem like a confident guy, Ian, but I know that all of us, we do get beat down. If we set out to win, we think we can win, we want to win, we feel we should, and we don't, that hurts. And that can be pretty detrimental sometimes to our training, to our performance on races and everything else. So maybe this sounds like a cop-out to you. I hope it doesn't. It's just strategies that I have noticed have really helped me in prioritizing my races both physically and mentally. I don't know if you guys have anything to add to that.
So here's an example. We have a great Tuesday night race series in Reno, and some of the races have points for this overall series championship and some don't. So what I did is I'm better at, like, crits and time tiles and that kind of thing. The ones that didn't have points, what I would do is so my move in a crit is like a breakaway with, like, I don't know, 5-10 minutes to go. I would do that on the ones that didn't have points, and I would purposefully do it in a wrong spot, knowing I was going to get caught, and just, like, attack a bunch that race so that it was going to be a really good workout. But that when I did it and the points thing, everyone goes, oh, Nate's going to blow up. He always blows up. This is what he does every time. But on those ones, I'd be smarter and I'd sit in the entire race. I'd save all my energy and then just do one huge explosion at the end. And because that was my focus, right? So I kind of laid some strategy down, and I won the point series, and I think I won most of the crits that year, 4 points. And the ones I didn't right get points in, sometimes I was last place because the group would just pass me by and everyone's, like, rolling their eyes at me. But I won, so there.
And that, I don't want to get overly dramatic here, but I think, I mean, if you look back, every general and every war, they concede certain win or certain battles, right?
You can't simply be everywhere.
Exactly.
It's like, if you defend everything, you actually defend nothing. That's what they, that's the phrase.
Yeah, exactly. Fantastic. Yeah, that's the best way to say it. And look at pros. They do that well. So maybe, Ian, maybe you're just like, you're a big fish in a small pond. I don't know if that's the case, and you just win everything. Because you mentioned that you go in with that mentality, but I don't know what the outcome is. But hopefully all that helps. Hopefully that's good stuff for you. The next question we have is from Marco, and this one's a good opportunity to clarify heart rate a little bit, and power and everything else. So, Marco, you ask, how can you condition your heart rate so that it doesn't spike really fast, and what is that spike attributed to? He ride with guys that while on the same route with me have a lower active heart rate. So there's a number of things to address. Go ahead, Nate.
Yeah, so one thing, if you have a Garmin Ant Plus heart rate strap, and it's actually just branded Garmin. You probably see them around. There's a ton of them out there. Like, there's Cyclops has some. It's made from a whole different bunch of different brands. There is a known software bug in there where when you put that on and you have a bad connection, it spikes your heart rate up to like 230, or like it'll be just crazy high, and you're like, I'm not doing anything, but you know, mentally you look at your heart rate and like you go, I'm gonna die. Wahoo Fitness has since then, with their heart rate monitors, they rewrote the firmware and they removed that bug. But I get this question a lot. They're like, oh, I start it and, you know, if it's not all wet, your heart rate strap, and it, or if you're wearing, I've seen it too happen with some people who have like a thin jersey and yes, it's, you know, they're riding in the wind. Yep. Yeah. And like, it'll kind of dry the sensors out and stuff, or I don't know if it's touching it, but you can get these spikes, and it's really not, a heart rate spike, it's a problem with that strap. And there's probably, I don't know, 10 million of those out there. So if you have one of those, I would seriously consider getting probably the Wahoo ticker and see if that takes it away. I mean, two, if that doesn't do it, talk to your doctor, because your heart rate shouldn't just spike up really fast and then go away. You know, it's a gradual increase when you ride. You might have some arrhythmia or something. That could be scary. Maybe you want to do that first because it's your heart and you don't want to mess around with that.
I'd agree.
What about, Chad, about having guys on the same route with a lower active heart rate?
Yeah, so that's the other end of things. So if we can rule out the things that Nate's just talking about, arrhythmias and hardware malfunctions, if the guys you're riding with just have lower active heart rates in general, that's probably due to improved fitness. And that's one possibility. The other possibility is you simply have a higher resting heart rate, a higher max heart rate than they do. So, you know, you can either simply address your fitness, keep training, and they'll start to, that disparity will start to narrow, or, lost my train of thought.
So another thing too is heart rate doesn't really mean you're more fit. Like, it's stroke volume times the amount of your heart beats, right? So that shows how much blood you can pump. It's kind of like, imagine you're in a car and you have four cars lined up and you're on the highway and you're going the same speed, and you're like, hey, that guy's RPMs are lower than mine. Does that mean he has a faster car or something? I know this is kind of a weird analogy, but you shouldn't be looking at you don't race on heart rate. Like, it's different, and people are different with the way that your heart actually responds. Jonathan and I were just talking about this, about pros now taking medicine to relax the lining of their heart so that they can push more blood per beat. It's crazy. So they have a low heart rate, but just push more blood.
Yeah, and Marco, something else? Definitely questionable. No, go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's definitely questionable stuff. And Chad, you're on a train of thought. Go ahead. I'll chime in after.
Just as you're riding with these guys and you're noticing that your heart rate's higher, don't make that the sole metric or the only thing that you're looking at. You know, how do you feel at that time? Are you dying and hanging on and they're all breathing through their noses, having no problem? In that case, then it's a fitness difference, and that's going to be addressed through training. But if you're all just kind of sailing along and chatting and your heart rate's higher, that's really nothing to concern yourself with. That's just your heart rate relative to you only.
Yeah. A good way to say it is, I guarantee you I've beaten people in races where I had a higher average heart rate the entire race than them.
Yeah, and I'm sure vice versa. Yeah. Other people with lower heart rates
exactly.
beating you.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and this is, and just to clarify too, we don't have any type of partnership with Wahoo or anything else like that. That's just what we've seen, and we get to see a lot of heart rate data, keep in mind, right? So this is a really common thing, and we actually had a parent on the junior team that I advise. We had a parent actually take their son out of cycling and completely pause all athletic endeavors because they had a heart rate strap that when he was going downhill and his jersey was flapping at speed, he was reading 280 beats per minute. Turns out he was totally fine. He was checked out by a doctor, though. They did the smart thing, and he's back to it now. But it's extremely common. And to be honest, the best way to do that is to go through, like Nate said, with the doctor, but then also use different heart rate straps. And the Wahoo one I have been using for 3 years now and never had a spike, not once. So that's something to check out. So Todd, you mentioned you like the podcast that we have going on here. So that's good stuff. And like many of us, I am currently sweet spot based training. The time I have for training varies from week to week in unexpected ways. Some weeks I could train 7.5 hours. Others I struggle to get 4 hours in. I understand that you have tailored a volume that's specific to each training plan, or for what he's trying to say here, the volume that you have on these training plans, the training volume trends gently or consistently, I guess is the best way to say it. So Todd's question: can you swap out 1 week of low volume for a week of mid volume or vice versa and still have the desired training effect? And once again, this is a common situation, a person that has a lot of time to train 1 week and then life happens and not so much time. Should they be adjusting training plan volume versions if that's the case, Chad, or what should they do?
Yeah, you can, Todd. There's no harm in that. Or at least, you know, if your body responds positively to it, there's no harm in it. We use the weekly increases in TSS to keep your fitness trending upward. But if, you know, as you put it, life intervenes and you only have a couple hours a week, just shift your focus for those weeks where maybe you can only squeeze in a couple workouts, then hit the intensity. You know, realize that you're not going to be able to put in the hours, so you're going to have to make the most of the limited time you're going to spend on the bike, and you'll at least maintain your fitness. And then when you jump back in there, maybe, you know, you find you've got a couple extra hours and you can handle a little bit extra and nudge that stress up a little higher and get yourself back on track. But these plans are shapeable for those very reasons. I mean, we can't all stick to them as they're exactly prescribed.
Chad, I have a question. So let's say I'm through a build halfway and I go on vacation and I don't bring my bike because my wife's like, no way are you riding your bike during our vacation. I think that's pretty common. What would you suggest in that case?
The biggest concern there is the slip in your aerobic fitness. Aerobic fitness is fickle and it's sensitive. So if you're not on it, you know, if you do very little other than, you know, laying on the beach and drink Mai Tais over the course of that period, you're going to lose some aerobic fitness. And that's the long, slow, hard stuff to build back up. Very time intensive. So it's not to say you have to get on the bike. You don't have to jump on a life cycle in a gym. But if you can do something that taxes your aerobic system, you know, jog on the beach, go on a hike, anything that elevates your heart rate and feels like work, then you're gonna mitigate that slip.
Yeah, I think one thing, and I can't hit home enough on this one, because I've seen people actually do this very thing and then they end up just putting themselves in a hole. Like Chad said, just to reiterate, make sure that you're keeping tabs on how you feel and what you're actually doing so that you can see if it is jumping up to too much volume for you. So let's see. The next question is from Russell. Excellent job on the blog and podcast, guys. 5 stars for sure. I wish he could rate our blog 5 stars. I guess just talking about it works, right? So I'm just planning my training for the next season. I'm looking to specialize for the British Road Hill Climb time trial season, which tends to be between 2 and 6 minute efforts and climbs. So relatively short climbs. So you've got a couple questions. I would assume a sweet spot base phase would be suitable, and I would also assume the build plan would be short power build due to the length of the race duration. I would appreciate your advice on the preferred specialty phase. Something that challenges his VO2 max is what he's talking about. Maybe the off-road or cyclocross or gravity plans. So Chad, it sounds like the sweet spot base stuff and short power build is good, but what would you recommend for a specialty plan there?
Yeah, actually a lot of our plans work because VO2 max is a component of just about everything when it comes to the build training and certainly the specialty training. Cyclocross and the Gravity Plan are both good fits. So is the Criterium Plan. And then I'm actually going to be putting together a pursuit plan, which is very specific to what you're talking about, 2 and 6 minute efforts. And I don't exactly understand the race format. If you mean you have to repeat these 2 and 6 minute efforts, or if it's a single all out 2 or 6 minute effort, 2 to 6 minute effort. In either case, the pursuit plan is going to focus solely on building your power at VO2 max.
And then the next part of his question, I'm only in my second year of cycling and first year of competition. I want to reach my peak over the next 5 to 6 years and don't mind sacrificing a couple of seasons for the greater end goal. So should I consider a long-term training approach? For example, do a couple of years of base with sustained power builds and then build your aerobic base fitness and then concentrate on VO2 max later on in your career? Or hit the VO2 max plans early every year, as this is where I want to specialize. So plan the long ball.
Yeah, you're almost talking like a quadrennial approach that an Olympic athlete would take. And that's pretty extreme. And it's probably a little too severe for someone whose fitness isn't nearly maxed out. So my recommendation would be to just follow a typical annual cycle and do it every year very consistently. So you start with your base and then move on to your build and then specialize and then maybe revisit a build and specialize again. But in any case, each next year's fitness is going to build on the previous year's fitness. So you're just going to get increasingly fit over those years as long as you maintain that consistency and that momentum. I don't think it has to be quite as structured as you're making it, not in the long term, rather address it more on an annual basis. And each year will be a little better than the one prior, maybe a lot better.
Yeah, that's one of the goals of periodization. Operating at, you know, it operates at a lot of different scales. And if you are periodizing your training as you go throughout the year, then you're going to be giving your body, you're not going to be exhausting your body over, you know, a long term. You're going to be giving it the adequate rest that it needs. So another point there for periodization.
Yeah. So basically you come into the season and you work on your base training. And then when you come into next season, that base is a little bit higher. And then the next season, that base is a little bit higher. And then everything you build on that base gets a little higher also.
Tim, my work requires a lot of air travel, sometimes every other week for 2 to 3 days at a time. I'm currently a Cat 4 road cyclist looking to get enough points in 2016 to upgrade to a Cat 3 as my primary goal. It seems whenever I train after I fly, my high intensities are shot. My heart rate is much higher for the effort level I am putting out. I prefer sprints and crits. I drink plenty of water and try to eat as healthy as possible while on the road, and I wear compression socks on the flights. But it seems to take 2 days at least to get back to where I can hit my VO2 max targets. Are there any tips on training to lessen this effect? What do you think, Chad?
I think we kind of addressed this last week, and it's the same answer. You might just need a day or two of lower intensity riding before you hit that harder stuff. If you're diving into it and your body's simply not ready for it, you're probably not going to hit those marks. You're not going to, you know, get the adaptation that you're shooting for. So it might be as simple as just one lower intensity workout. You know, maybe do something that's more sweet spot in nature and then see how the workout goes the second day. Maybe you need two of those days, but a little trial and error to see what sort of lower intensity training gets you back on track and helps you, you know, hit those goals when it comes to your higher intensity stuff.
Let's talk airport hacks a bit on this one. Is there anything that you guys have done, either of you, in traveling to make sure that there's a lessened impact on your training?
One thing I do is I always carry a water bottle. So I have it empty during when I go through, but then I fill it up as soon as I go through security and drink that, because the water that they give you on the plane is never enough. I do compression socks, walk around. Sometimes when you fly too, when I go to the hotel, it's like, I have two kids, so I say, oh, alone time. I stay up later than I normally would. What I should be really doing is going to sleep. And it's hard too, because when you travel someplace, usually, you know, you're doing work stuff and then they want to take you out to dinner. And it's this long dinner. And you get back to the hotel at, you know, 9 or 10, and then, but you have to be at the office at 7 the next day. I feel your pain. Chad, do you have anything?
Not really. I try to drive to most of my races. I really despise air travel. So unfortunately, I'm not much help on this topic.
I know for me, I always keep in mind the, you know, if you can, when standing, if you can sit, when sitting, if you can lay down, and that type of deal.
Sorry. Nate. One thing, I just traveled internationally to Japan, and I was with a guy who, you know, flies. He's in the 100,000 mile United Club, but he got me into the United like special area, and boy, was that was so much better than being with all the cattle of the airport people everywhere else. They gave you, there's like this buffet of food. You had high internet access or high internet, high speed internet access. You had really comfortable chairs and stuff. And if you fly a lot, and you probably already know this if you fly a lot, but getting into one of those clubs where you can go to like a quieter area where there's just, it's a little bit more relaxing. I feel like there's less stress, especially if you have a long layover. And then the other thing he did, you know, I'm 6'6", I'm a tall guy. I was in United in the back, and this is pretty obvious, but he flew business class with his wife, and his wife could like slept half the flight, you know, and they brought her like snacks every hour or two, and they came off the flight just happy and cheery, and I was, you know, exhausted and tired, and that's common, right? If you can fly business, fly business.
Yeah, that was going to be my number one tip. Just go first class or business. But that's a little easier said than done in a lot of cases. One thing that I do if I'm flying coach, I try to sit in the emergency exit rows because those give me a little more leg room. This is like marginal gains stuff.
I hate you. You're not tall. How tall are you, Jonathan?
I'm just under 6 foot. So
yeah.
I take spots from guys like Nate. Nate, you're 6'7".
You're tall, but I'm 6'6", but yeah. You're tall and I have extra long legs. But you are tall, but when I see someone who's not above my height, I get jealous.
So I take those seats. The other thing I do is if I have any type of flexibility with my boarding position and I don't really have to get off the plane so quick, I don't follow the completely illogical impulse of just standing in line and sitting on the plane for as long as I can. I try to spend as much time outside of that seat as possible. Like, think of this like Team Sky, like how they would think of it, right? Like marginal gains in every way. Another thing I do is I focus 100%. I turn into a germaphobe at the airport, but it doesn't seem to do me any harm. It only seems to do me well. And then outside of that, I always try to take advantage of every opportunity to not walk wherever possible, like to take the escalators, to ask that friendly guy for a ride on the golf cart through the airport, whatever it might be. So, and I totally don't need that or deserve it, but if I can take advantage of it, I will if I have a race coming up that I'm worried about. So those are just little, I guess, airline tips that I would have there. And then driving in a car, if you can, like compression socks are huge for me driving in a car. And if you can, get somebody else to drive. I've always found that helpful. And then I also make sure that I get out of the car every hour. And it takes longer on the trip, but I try to plan for that. And I get out of the car and I stretch. And then the last tip that I would have a stretching regimen that you can perform regardless of equipment that you have and stick to that. And that'll really help. I always find that allows me to come into my workouts a lot more limber, rested, and relaxed. And that really helps. So I hope that's good for you, Tim. Next question is from Sam. I'm going to run through a number of the different situation you have here. So bear with us, everybody else. Hopefully his situation relates somewhat to yours. Sam, you're new to indoor training and structured workouts. I've blindly trained myself, long rides of 60 to 100 miles on weekends with friends, or three or four rides of 30 to 50 miles during the week, of which one or two, are group rides. So you've just been basically just riding, right? You've become a decent triathlete by doing so. Several podiums and sprints, Olympic 70.3, and just got your first Ironman podium in Ironman Louisville last month. So good. Yay. Job. You got fourth in the 50 to 54 division. Nice job, man. Good stuff. I bought a kicker and have just come off a couple weeks of Ironman Louisville recovery, and I did my first ever FTP test at 273 watts. My goal race is to go back to Ironman Louisville in October and land a Kona spot, hoping Trainer Robe will give me that extra 3-5% performance boost that I need. So your question is this. I was thinking, following your traditional base, mid or high volume plan, and then move into the sustained build high volume plan, and the full distance triathlon high volume plan. Does that sound reasonable? So first things first, Chad, with the volumes, the low, mid, and high volume, how should you pick low, mid, and high volume?
Yeah, when it comes to base training, really, unless you can do high volume, you should be on the sweet spot plan. In the case, you may not have the option, and that, you know, that's another issue. But in his case, if he can choose between medium or high, the high volume is absolutely the way to go. If for no other reason than ultra distance athletes and triathletes and Ironman competitors really need to focus or target their aerobic fitness. It's really a measure of how high you can push your aerobic fitness, because that's where you're going to operate all day. So to that end, anything that addresses aerobic base improvement or aerobic fitness improvement and fat metabolism and basically all day power is the route that we definitely send you. So if you can go high volume, absolutely go high volume. In fact, it's gotten to the point where we kind of steer people away from the low and mid volume traditional plans, because you know what you can't do in intensity, you have to do in volume, and the lower volume, low intensity plans simply have neither. So if you can do the high volume, then traditional is a viable option. If it's not, veer sweet spot. And then beyond that, your sustained approach targeting improvements in FTP and then a plan specific to triathlon are absolutely the right way to go.
And two, with the high volume, just be aware as a triathlete, you know, you have two other sports, which I've seen though a lot of Kona guys can do, you know, 20 hours a week. High volume's about 10 hours, and it peaks at about almost 13 hours at the last phase. If you can do that, do it. But if you can't, then, you know, don't set yourself up for failure.
Yeah, great point. And those low and mid volume traditional base plans, if anything, those are best utilized perhaps as supplementary plans. Is that correct, Chad? If you're going to be doing a lot of other stuff outside of just following the structured plan there on Trainer Road. Because they're certainly not, it's not as if there's no value there. There certainly is. It's just
no, there definitely is. And for some people, even the mid for sure, perhaps the low also could be enough of a departure from what they've done. I mean, these are trainer rides, and it's really consistent, steady stress. And that in and of itself could be enough of a change in the way they've been training to actually to make them a bit fitter. So it's still not wasted time. And if you're in the midst of one of those and it seems to be working, keep with it. You don't need to jump tracks all of a sudden. If it's working, stick with it.
Especially that mid volume too. The mid volume, as you get farther into it, we're kind of mixing messages here, but I just don't want someone to feel like, oh, I'm in mid volume traditional base and I'm just wasting my time. No. It's still okay to do that. And we're also going to have some specific triathlon plans. They're in the works, and Chad is pretty far through those.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll have more info on that in the coming weeks. So that'll do it for the questions this week. Thanks for submitting them. You can submit the questions that you do have, the ones that perhaps didn't get answered or anything else, can submit them to support@trainerroad.com. They'll point you in the right direction to get that question into the queue for the next podcast that'll be coming up. So this is the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it on SoundCloud. You can listen to it there. You can give us reviews on iTunes. We'd appreciate it. And we're glad that you guys are with us here. Thanks for thanks for listening in, and happy training.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.